I just wanted to discuss today is it's not so often appreciated that you know, Parshas Bereishis, in a certain sense, the first parsha in the Torah, is in a very real sense the most disappointing, and the parsha that contained within it is the single greatest failure. That is to say that the entire beginning of the parsha, the first 60 to 70 psukim of the parsha, are about God's painstaking creation and the idea of humans and their capacity for partnership with God. Na'ase Adam b'tzalmenu kidmusenu, the idea that humanity was supposed to be created in the image of God. And at the very end of the parsha, God looks around. This is, you know, not me talking, but the Torah itself testifies that God looks around. Vayar Hashem kira baras Adam ba'aretz, that people's wickedness was enormous, was considerable. V'chol machshavos yetzli bo rak rakol hayom, that, you know, humans are almost exclusively nefarious in their activities. And, you know, this is a remarkable thing, that in a single parsha we went from a theme of construction and hope and, you know, this incredible vision for a world that's created, to a world that's in total chaos and on the brink of destruction. Happens to be that there's like a little glimmer of hope at the very end of Parshas Bereishis, of Noach matzachin be'enei Hashem, that Noach finds favor in God's eyes. Now, God doesn't say that, and therefore I'm going to save the world. It sounds like the world is still going to be destroyed. So it's just important to appreciate on its face how, you know, depressing and unnerving Parshas Bereishis really is. That in a very short space, at least as far as the Torah is concerned, even though there are 10 generations, which are, you know, Me'adam ad Noach, nonetheless, you know, one finds that this is a very kind of a depressing parsha. As a matter of fact, the Mishnah in the fifth parak of Pirkei Avos says, Asara Doros me Adam ad Noach, that there are 10 generations from Adam to Noach. You can count them down. Adam had a son named Shase, and Shase had a son named Enosh, and Enosh had a son named Canaan, and Canaan had a son named Mahalalel, and Mahalalel had a son named Yared, and Yared had a son named Chanoch, and Chanoch had a son named Metushelach, and Metushelach had the same name Lamech, and Lamech had the same name Noach. So that's the 10 generations. So it's covering a lot of years, but, you know, in as far as the Torah is concerned, a very short amount of time. And the Mishnah says, Lahodia, this teaches us, Kama erech apayim lefanav, that God is really patient. Shekol adoros hayu machisinu va'im, that each generation was really worse than the one that came before it. Which is an interesting comment in its own right. Ad shehetziyef aleihem esmei babel, until God, as it were, couldn't take it, and he had to bring destruction to the world. So, you know, Parshas Bereishis is the story of construction and creation on the one hand, and then at the same time, the story of the seeds of that destruction. From the very beginning of Parshas Noach, the Torah tells us that God looked at the world, v'hinei nishchasa, the world had been destroyed. Now, not physically destroyed yet, but morally, spiritually, ethically speaking, corrupted and corroded to the point where the Torah could literally say, "Vayar lekim es haaretz v'hinei nishchasa," that the word that the Torah uses of hashchata, of literal destruction, is very significant. God created, and human beings destroyed. You know, God built it into humanity from the very beginning that we were God's partners, and partners can either be very helpful, as we know, or very destructive. And in this case, human beings were very destructive. And that's kind of the infrastructure upon which I wanted to build today's shiur. That's the necessary background. So we know that what God determines is that since the world has already been spiritually destroyed, he's going to bring a physical destruction that sort of matches it. Some people here have read a picture of Dorian Gray. So with the premise of that particular novel is, right, that there's this moral, ethical corrosion of this individual. You can't necessarily see it on the outside. If you go to the picture in the attic, you can see everything that's been corroded. That's a very good metaphor for what Parshas Noach is all about. If you go to the picture in the attic, things are already destroyed. You know, so the mabul, the flood that comes, is an opportunity sort of for the, now I'll use, because I, you know, we use the literary metaphor, So now we'll use the scientific metaphor. It's an opportunity for the phenotype to match the genotype. That is to say that the exterior, the world is actually going to now be physically destroyed, whereas internally speaking, it had already been materially destroyed by human beings and their corruption. And their corruption in many different ways. The Torah uses the term Hamas, which relates to Gazel, that there was no respect for boundaries and properties. I mentioned before the term Hashchasa, which connotes a sexual immorality. The Gemara discusses in great detail the pathologies of the Dor HaMabul, but again, the Dor HaMabul, as we just noted, based on the Mishnah and Pirkei Avos, they were just the final generation, but this has all been building up for a very long time, for thousands of years preceding it in the space between Adam and Noach. So we all know the story. The flood comes, and God decides that he's not going to totally destroy the world. There's going to be like this, one point of continuity. And that point of continuity is Noach, that God had basically two options at this point, to totally wipe the slate clean and to start over with like a new Adam, or to say that, okay, we're going to save a person. It's interesting God chooses the latter option. Okay, you can think about why it was that God chose to do that. Not for now, don't worry about it. A little beyond our scope for today. But God chooses the latter of the two options, namely that it isn't once complete, a completely new world. He wants some degree of continuity, and the continuity is going to be through the personality of Noach, Noach's sons, his wife, and his sons' wives, respectively. Okay, so God chooses to have this point of continuity, and the way that this works is that the Teva, the ark, is going to be the vessel of salvation. So the premise of this year that I'd like to lay out at the very beginning is that the Teva really had what we would call in Gemara terms two dinim, that there are really two different aspects of the Teva. One of them was a boat that was meant to withstand the flood. So there was a pragmatic dimension of the Teva. That is to say that if you looked at the Teva and its architecture, you would say, oh, this was intelligently designed to withstand the flood. So for example, it didn't have a flat roof, right? If rain is pounding down on the roof, so you don't want a flat roof. What you want is a slanted roof, right? So the basic laws of physics. So the roof is slanted, ve'el ama techalena milmala, to be able to deflect the water off to the sides. And there are two other architectural features that are not moral, that are purely pragmatic. The ark was coated both on the inside and the outside with tar, right? If you want to be able to insulate a boat against water penetration, it's a good idea that you should use some kind of a sealant, right? All boats today, even ones that are made not of wood but of metal, are provided with sealants, both on the inside and the outside. So certainly when it comes to a wooden boat like the Teva, and by the way, the wood that was used was chosen because it happened to be the most water-resistant wood available. So you have all these practical dimensions, the shape of the roof, the fact that it's insulated on the inside and the outside, the choice of the wood, the fact that the door is put on the side. It says, "Upetach ha-teva b'tzidat asim," Rashi famously comments, right? Because if the door is going to be in the roof, it's probably not such a good idea, right? You want it on the side where it's going to be vented. So that's what I would call din number one, the pragmatic aspect of the Teva. But what I think is much more interesting is the fact that Teva was also a moral creation. The architectural features were not only meant to spare Noach and his family, but the Teva had architectural features that were really meant not as pragmatic forms of just keeping people alive and the animals that were going to be on the Teva, but were meant to actually serve as a kind of moral restorative to society. And that's really what I wanted to focus on, is that the Teva became the microcosm of a world reborn. And the way that God wanted the Teva designed was as a kind of a rebirth point, that you could look at the Teva and say, this was the world that God intended, as I'm going to explain, and from this Teva, the world should be reborn. So in that way, the Teva both had practical aspects to it, but also moral or ethical aspects to it. So let me just give an example. The Torah stresses, both at the end of Parashas Bereishis, the beginning of Parashas Noach, that Vayar Lekim Es Aretz V'nei Nishchasa, that there was kind of destruction, and all of the rabbinic literature points in one direction, that God created the world Liminehu. That if you look at the beginning of Parshas Bereishis, the beginning of the Torah, so God created the world with certain species. And we know that one of the prohibitions in the Torah is kilayim. We're not supposed to mix different species together. That's true at the level of plants, that's true at the level of animals, that there are certain kinds of unions that are permissible, there are certain kinds of unions that are prohibited. And one of the features, one of like the defining features of the Dor HaMabul is this exact point that there's all this kind of inappropriate mixing going on. So, for example, we talk about animals cohabiting with animals that were not from their species, humans cohabiting with animals. So in order to reverse this process, the Teva is actually painstakingly designed to reflect God's initial intended moral hierarchy for the universe. Because what do we know about the Teva? Tachtiim shnishi shniim ushlishim ta'aseha. That there were three levels. And as the rabbis explain in the Gemara Masachah Sanhedrin, human beings are at the apex. They live on the top level. Then you have animals in this mezzanine level. And then at the bottom level, you have all the refuse, all the garbage. So again, you could look at this merely as pragmatic, but I think it's something far more significant. I think there's a moral spiritual point here, namely that God is attempting to restore the initial hierarchy, implicit or explicit even, in creation, where human beings are not meant to be the same as animals. And so in the Teva, they live on top of the animals as a way of saying this was God's plan for the universe altogether. The Torah uses the word kinim. Kinim is interpreted by Unklus as Rashi as madurin, that the animals didn't just live on the second level, but there were various private stalls, or we would call them in a modern office setting cubicles, that each of the animals had its own section. And this, of course, was meant to reinforce the point that the animals are not supposed to be mixing with each other, that God wants each species to have its own integrity within the species itself. So again, here the architecture of the Teva, you could say, oh, this kept it easier. Noach knew that he was now entering the section of, you know, large cats, like if you go to the zoo. You could interpret it that way, but I'd prefer to interpret it in, again, a moral or ethical way, that what God was really looking to do is to say, look at the Teva. This Teva is a microcosm of the world as it should be, and I want, when you emerge from the Teva, as we'll read, Semina Teva, the Teva becomes literally the germ, the seed from which the rest of the world is supposed to grow, where all of these boundaries and hierarchies that were really such an important part of creation to begin with, you have the 6 days of creation, all in a particular order, moving from vegetation to animal life to higher human life. It's all done kiseder, with a very important moral hierarchy. The Teva becomes the basis of a world that is recreated, a world with proper boundaries. And that brings me really to the final but most important point that I wanted to dwell on, the last architectural feature of the Teva, but again, one that's much less pragmatic, at least initially, than it is ethical or spiritual. And that is the concept of Tzohar Ta'aseh La'Teva. Tzohar. What is the Tzohar? So here you have two different opinions in the Gemara, both of which are cited by Rashi. It either means a chalon, a window, or that there was some kind of, as Unklus prefers, nahor, a light. That there was some kind of, and Rashi, based on the rabbinic literature, speculates that the light came from, if light isn't coming from the sun, because it's a closed environment, so that they had some kind of gemstones that were emitting light. There's obviously a very deep and profound metaphor here in terms of whether you understand the Tzohar to be a chalon, a window by definition lets in light from the outside, or you understand that it's actually a nahor, an internal light, avanim tovos, margolios, that there were jewels. And the real question that's obviously being debated is somehow the Teva drawing its light from without, or is it drawing its light from within? Is there such destruction going on the outside that the only way that you could have illumination in the Teva is illumination from within? That's a very important idea. So the Gemara says that during the Mabul, that all of the heavenly bodies, the sun, the moon, the stars, lo shimshu, that they did not function regularly. And the Gemara makes this induction on the basis of pretty strong evidence in the Chumash itself, when God says after the flood, Od kol yemei ha'aretz, from this point on, I'm never going to cause a cessation in the normal cosmology. Things are going to run normally. Od kol yemei ha'aretz, zer v'katzir v'kor v'chom, v'kayetz v'choref, yom v'layla lo yishbosu. From now on, day and night are always going to follow each other. winter and summer are going to follow each other. The planting season, the harvesting season, everything is going to run normally. The Gemara infers on that basis that during the Mabul, things did not run normally. In other words, there was no basis for bringing in any external light. If there was going to be illumination, it would have to be generated from within. And it's that perspective that I'm really trying to highlight this afternoon. That is to say that with respect to the Teva, according to this view, that the illumination was from within, the Teva basically had to be a morally self-sufficient environment. It couldn't rely on the external world, which had to be destroyed, for any kind of illumination. And it was going to become the basis, later on, from Semin HaTeva, for a world that would be recreated in the image of everything that was going on in the Teva. And I think that this metaphor is particularly important when we discuss spiritual life more broadly. When we think about the Teva as a kind of a model for how we can live in different societies. You know, sometimes we're living in a world from which we can take a great deal, where the Tzohar Tasela Teva, metaphorically speaking, really is a chalon, and that we're best served by having a window which is open to society, a window which is able to bring in light from the outside, and we're able to be inspired and directed and guided and educated and edified by all that's going on around us. And that's Tzohar in the sense of chalon, of being open to everything that's going on outside. And sometimes, like in the generation of Noach, that's really not morally possible. The chalon is not going to bring you illumination. On the contrary, it's going to bring all of the pathologies, all of the darkness, all of the destruction inside to your protected and insular environment. Sometimes your Tzohar really has to be, as is the other opinion in the Gemara, as is Unklus' preferred view, Nehora, it has to be an internal light, Even Tova, Margoliot Tovot. It has to be an internal light. Your moral compass has to be an internal one. Now, the question is always, you know, there are some people who will always tell you that we should be open to the outside world no matter what, and things can never be too corrupt from their point of view. Then you have extremists on the other side, is that we should always be insular. There's nothing good to be learned. You know, the question of judgment is to know when we should have the Tzohar in the sense of a chalon, and when we should have a Tzohar in the sense of an internal compass. But the point is that you have to be sufficiently aware of your surroundings to know, is this a time and a place where we can be drawing light from the outside and looking for guidance from society? Or is this a time where we really have to be primarily internally driven, as is the case in Noach's time, and you know, use our own best lights to direct us, our own internal lights? So I thought that would be a particularly relevant now, relevant message now, this time of year, as we move away from the Yom Tov season. The Yom Tov season, by definition, provides a lot of external inspiration. We go through Rosh Hashanah, and then, of course, Yom Kippur, and the Sukkot, Zman Simchasenu, followed by Shmini Atzeres and Simchas Torah. There's a lot of external spiritual stimuli that even if you don't necessarily feel the greatest stimulation from within, the calendar itself, the days themselves, force you to a certain spiritual place. Some years better than others, but there's always the possibility of chalon, of stimulation from without. But once you get to the part of the year that we're now entering, where we don't have nearly as much external stimulation, spiritually speaking, we really have to be able to provide our own sense of illumination, our own sense of light. That's really the challenge of this part of the year. There are opportunities that come with that as well, but the challenge is to be able to provide a light from within. We're no longer going to have a yantif every 3 days to, give us an opportunity to focus on a new theme, on a new mitzvah. It's going to become, by definition, a certain kind of rote, a certain kind of habituated calendar, and that requires, spiritually speaking, much more of us. The reason that I say this is an opportunity as well is because this is actually a much more authentic barometer of our own spiritual existence. The Rambam has an incredibly insightful comment on the Mishnah in the first parak of Avos, famous Mishnah. Hillel said, "Im ein ani li mili." If I am not for myself, then who will be for me? The way the Rambam interprets that line is that, basically, you could always go to a nice shir, some other kind of shir than this one, a nice shir, and, get a little bit of a shot in the arm. But that only lasts for so long. So the Rambam says, what Hillel meant when he said, "Im ein ani li Mele, if I'm not going to be my own greatest source of inspiration, what I call the internal tzohar, the tzohar in the sense of unklus, of nehora, if I cannot provide my own best lights, mele, who will be able to provide this for me? Because the difference is, as the Rambam points out so incisively, as only he could, the external stimulation basically lasts as long as that stimulation is going on, or maybe if you're lucky, for a little while thereafter, you can bask in the glow of, whatever it is that you heard. But then, 10 minutes later, 20 minutes later, what's your only source of inspiration? Yourself. That's who you're with, all day long, by definition. We'll always be with ourselves all day. So, im ein ani li, if I'm not going to be my own stimulant, my own catalyst, my own spiritual energizer, mili, then who in the world is going to be able to provide spiritual stimulation for myself? So we're now shifting, point is, from a time in the year where the tzohar is the chalon, where all we have to do really is to be open to receiving the great illumination around us, provided by the season of the Yamim Tovim, to the season of tzohar in the sense of Evan Tovam or Goliot Tovot, of being able to provide our own spiritual stimuli. So it's always a balance, and we can always try to tap into other people or various spiritual opportunities around us for inspiration. And there's always a time for that. But this time of the year in the calendar is much more defined by our capacity to stimulate ourselves internally. And that's really the challenge going forward. So hopefully we'll all, bear that in mind and try to be as successful as possible in cultivating within ourselves a sense of tzohar tasela teva, nehora, an internal light which is able to provide spiritual direction, spiritual energy, and sustenance as we go into the part of the year where, until Hanukkah times, until the external lights of the Hanukkah candles will be able to inspire us anew from the outside, over the next 2 months, literally, basically 2 months from today until Hanukkah, we're going to have to be our own best source of illumination.
Okay.